Oh, this is a very, very important topic for Australia, and it has meaning, more meaning than at any other time in my professional life. So I basically have about 6 hours of stuff to talk about, and then when I finish, you'll probably not be any clearer than when I started, and partly it's age, but it's mainly... things are quite difficult and quite strange, and I'll tell you why. When I first began in policy, the major problem you had was that our prime ministers and our treasurers and our Reserve Bank governors were all very strong, self-centred people who believed they were running the world. So when they said, oh, we do this, the interest rate goes up and Australia does that, we do this and then Australia does that, they were basically telling lies, but they didn't know. Because when they did this, Australia did what they thought it would do. And the reason why that happened, basically, was when they did that, America did that. And what that really meant in those days, people used to say, when America sneezes, Australia catches a cold. So our people used to pretend they were running the world, but it was really coming out of the US. So that meant, in a way, life was pretty safe, you know, in the sense that you knew what was happening. It was happening because of the US. And you can plot all the series you like, and it's just remarkable how close they are. Not only because America has direct links here, but America links to other countries who links here. And the reason why this topic now is so difficult is those links have gone, in the sense that it's no longer true that what happens in America happens here instantaneously. And you saw that, right, in the first speech with the house crisis. And you see it in other ways. So if you were to look at the US today, you'd ask two questions. One is, how come Australia's doing so well? And when does the collapse occur? You know? And the reason why it's become complicated is because of, as you all know, China and India. And the impact of China and India on Australia is quite different from the old US impact. The China-Indian impact is coming straight through the export markets, straight through the price of minerals and so on, right? Whereas the US impact was sort of all-pervasive. And so that means now that our policymakers are in real strife, because on the one hand, they've got the US tugging us one way, and on the other hand, China and India tugging us the other. So for the first time, you really have to think in two dimensions, as it were, the US and someone else. Well, you never had to do that before. And that's really very, very tricky, right? The other reason why it's really tricky is that the China is not really as dependent on the US as you might imagine, even though all its exports essentially go to the US. And that's because China's growth rate now is increasingly being dominated by internal growth rate within China. So it's unhooking itself from the US. So it might well be that the US downturn will impact on Chinese exports, but it won't really impact that much on China's growth, perhaps. So I'll just show you some little pictures. This one is really very important because this illustrates another point. This is copper and iron prices in Australian dollars, and I could put any sort of basic material prices on here. Starts at 84 and it goes to 2007. Says that up to about 3 years ago, the world was normal in the sense that copper prices in real terms were at the lowest level they'd been since 1890, that iron ore prices were just gradually drifting up like they always had did. There was no crisis involved here. If you were coming out of that period, imagine yourself being an entrepreneur thinking about how much you're going to invest in copper. How much you want to expand the copper. Think how much you want to expand the iron ore prices, mines and so on, right? You're basically living in a world where everything's stable and predictable. Look at the last 3 years, and this is the biggest price change that these commodities have more or less ever experienced. Completely unforeseen, right? Because if they were foreseen, you wouldn't get this thing, right? So it's completely unforeseen. So the important thing to remember is that when I go, if I give this speech 3 or 4 years ago, it's not the speech you're giving now, right? Because it's the speech of all these very flat lines. So our problem is that these things, copper, iron ore, coal, are injecting money into the Australian economy at a level we've never experienced, basically since wool was a pound in the 1950s. So this huge injection through the export side. The government then is getting edgy because this is pushing the economy up. So it's tightening up interest rates and so on to try and adjust to this. But many of the people who are feeling the adjustment aren't these people, right? That is, the adjustment's being felt in Sydney, Victoria and Tasmania. So that's why you've got this really difficult balancing act going on. Now, how did we make this mistake? How did this price increase occur? And this is really very important and not that well understood. But when you look at a price depends on demand and supply. And when people are talking about these high prices in China and India being generated out of those countries, they always tend to focus on the demand side. China's growing, India's growing, prices will go up. But there was also a supply side. And the supply side, I told you before, is basically looking backwards and was based on all those flat prices. So you can see here, these are the real metal prices, and each one of these points is the start of a cycle. So you can think of this coming up to the boom, then slowing down. So the real kicker that happened this time around is essentially everything was sort of going normal as we came up to the boom, but we didn't get the decline in the boom. So this, the latest cycle has gone on longer than previously, longer than everybody anticipated, and that's primarily generating these big increases, in my view. So while it's true in the long term that China and India are going to demand many, many more of our resources, a lot of the kicker has come in because we misjudged the cycle. It just lasted a little longer. And what we've done now is, although the cycle will go away, these price increases now have been there long enough, they're now built into the contracts, mostly, right? So this will still keep coming for Australia. So the other thing which I should say, which you all know, is that the resources are not found in all the same places. They're not evenly spread. There are WA Queensland, mainly a WA Queensland phenomenon. And it's impacting in our country currently through WA and Queensland, and it's impacting primarily not through digging up more resources and selling them at this point. It's impacting mainly through preparing sites to dig up more resources. So this is private fixed investment, all the building that's going on. The pink line is WA and Queensland, and the blue line is Australia. So if I'm giving the talk in WA, I'm giving a different talk than if I give it in Sydney. Now, just as we've got a dual economy on the commodity side, we've also got one on the labour market side. I just want to show you this very quickly. Here, these are all the men who are employed full-time, divided by the population of men, 15 to 64. I started in 78. In 78, roughly 80%, 79% of men were employed. And then I follow Australia through the cycles. The dotted line is WA and Queensland. The thick line is the rest of Australia. So if you were thinking of Australia in labour market terms, and you narrow the labour market concept down to men and men who work full-time, you can see in this picture quite clearly that if you follow the Bs, which is us, New South Wales, Victoria, the Bs really don't have much of a boom going on in terms of extra employment for men. All the booms are basically in the A's, the Queensland and WA. Same thing is true of women. These were women who worked full-time, WA and Queensland, the rest of Australia. See, the dotted lines now exceed. So the question is, in a way, even though these markets are booming differently, geographically, do they spread in other dimensions? Do they spread, say, occupationally? So you can have a boom in WA and a slump in Sydney, but the executives of the company can be paid the same in WA and Sydney, right? But the unskilled labour make it very, very different. So here I've just plotted the males employed full-time by education, by skill levels. So these two lines are skills, essentially, and the dotted lines are skills for Australia. The black line now is the skills for Queensland and WA, and it's the growth rate since 97. You know, how much are they? 25% higher than they were in 97. The really interesting thing here is that by and large, although the booms are geographically located, and although the boom is impacting on the labour market differently, the education stuff is spreading everywhere. The skilled people, no matter where they're picking up the goodies. This is the unskilled labour market. This is Queensland and WA. This is the rest of us. So the group of people who are really feeling the differences in the labour market are the unskilled. And why is that? Well, mainly because there's an awful lot of mines being, you know, buildings being built, roads being prepared, and the unskilled men are involved in that in WA and Queensland, and very little happening elsewhere. This is just to show you it's not only a male phenomenon, this is a female phenomenon. See, female skills is the heavy black line. They're zooming along, unskilled at the bottom. So this boom is a very, very particular boom. Now, what should I do to... Oh, yeah, okay. So what I'll do now is just show you one... See, I'm running out of time. One really interesting phenomenon. What you've got going on in Australia is the markets are booming in WA and Queensland, commodities. The skilled labour is sharing it no matter where you are. The unskilled labour... You've got to be where the boom is in WA or Queensland. That's the sort of picture I've shown you. Now I'm going to talk about how separate are these markets, really. I'm only going to focus on one thing. I'm just going to show you pictures on migration from overseas and migration within Australia. These are going to be net figures. Okay? And I think they make a really very important point. This is WA. The pink line is net interstate migration. This number is zero, that number is 10,000. This is per year. What the pink line shows you, by and large, is hardly anybody goes from the eastern states to WA. Right? Hardly anybody goes. On balance, there's about 4,000 a year. And you see, there's no boom either in terms of easterners going away. This is international migration. So all the WA is picking up all the extra workers from international migration. This is Queensland. This is interstate migration. And this is international migration. And so you can see from this picture that for Queensland, they're getting as many workers from New South Wales and Victoria as they are from the migrants. So I think that's quite interesting too, because that says, which is not maybe that surprising, that the boom in Queensland has got a higher propensity to trickle down into New South Wales and Victoria by making people in New South Wales and Victoria go to Queensland. But they're not going to WA. So if there's going to be a fight about migration policy, WA is going to be at one end of this extreme, because that's where they're getting all their workers from, and the East Coast is going to be at another. So I might just finish there. We've got plenty of time for questions.